Hey, this is Brandon Crawford from the San Francisco Giants, and you're listening to TortureCast.
You're listening to a podcast by and for fans of the San Francisco Giants. Let's go, Giants! With hosts Willie Dills, Chad King, Ben Lee, and Eric Nathanson. Dedicated to the greatest team in Major League Baseball, the San Francisco Giants. This is TortureCast.
Mike Rizzo, the general manager. Dave Martinez, the field manager. Here they are, one strike away, one out away. 3-2. Here it is! The Washington Nationals are world champions for the first time in franchise history.
Congratulations to the Washington Nationals, winners of the 2019 World Series. First time they've ever won it in the city or province or town or territory or I don't even know what to call it anymore, Eric, but congratulations to the Nationals. I'm Chad King, and this is episode 186 here on Monday, November 4th, and I am joined by Eric for this version of TortureCast. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. I'm sad that the baseball season's over, but I'm glad that we got a seven-game World Series. Even if the World Series wasn't that exciting, I'm glad we got seven games because it makes this long, long winter a little more bearable.
Yeah, seven is always nice, and we've had seven in this is the 40th time the World Series has gone to seven games, so it's actually a pretty decent amount considering there's only been, 120 or so World Series. So it's a pretty good clip.
This decade was good for it, too. We had 2011 went seven games, 2014 went seven games, 2016, 2017, and now 2019. Yeah, so we've been lucky as baseball fans over the last decade.
So we'll dive into some fun stats and talk about the Giants' managerial search and some free agent stuff, but hopefully we won't go too long as we head into the official hot stove offseason right now, but just to kind of recap the World Series, of course, you and I did pick the Astros, but hey, look, most people did, including the Houston Mattress King. But of course, he was hedging his bets anyway, so he was gonna come out about the same no matter who won, and it gave him a lot of free publicity. So to be honest, it was a shrewd business move. I gotta tip my cap to him. It was really, really cool by him. But you know, the Nationals again really reminded me, and I'm sure you. We've talked about this last time 2 weeks ago. Of a combination of some of these Giants teams, but definitely 2010, just doing it in a very odd way. 2012 with a lot of comebacks. They did come back in the wild card game in the NLCS. NLDS. And then, of course, in this World Series, they were also down 3-2, came back and won all four on the road, won game seven after being down 2-0. It was very odd, too, because the road team won all seven games, and that's the first time that's ever happened in a seven-game series in any of the major North American sports. So who would have thought that was going to happen?
Yeah, it's a strange occurrence when fans of the home teams walked away from every single World Series game frustrated and upset. I mean, they spent all this money, thousands of dollars for World Series tickets, and no fans walked away happy from either park the entire series.
Isn't that funny? Yeah, no home fans walked away happy. Just visiting fans. That's it.
So. It's just so weird, though. I mean, it's not something that – I don't think it's something that ever any of us – and I'm talking anybody who watches baseball or does what we do. I don't think any of us ever thought that something like that was possible. Uh-huh. It just didn't compute. You know what I mean? It just never made sense. Like, why wouldn't a home team win a game, you know? And I don't know what accounts for that. I don't know if it's added pressure, but I can't imagine that it is. You're already in the World Series. That's a ton of pressure. So I don't know what to account for it other than it's a statistical oddity that happened. And I'll bet you we can go another 100 years and it won't happen again.
Oh, easily. Again, considering the fact that it's never happened in hockey or basketball as well. Let alone baseball. Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think you and I are going to see this again in our lifetime in any of those sports, but probably not baseball. And the other thing is the Astros had not lost four games in a row at home all year. So that was another new one. Who would have thought it? The Astros were 60-21 at home this year. Think about that. They won three out of every four games at home. and they lost four in a row in the World Series.
Yeah, and they lost five of their last seven home games when you throw in the Yankees series, because they lost game one to the Yankees, and then they won game two and won game six. But, I mean, for a team that dominated at home and seemed to have that advantage, it definitely was not. I mean, maybe they were pressing. I do think the Astros were pressing at times. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, we can talk about game seven specifically and how A.J. Hinch totally blew it. I was talking about it during the game. There's no reason to leave Gerrit Cole in the bullpen. There's no reason to you either ride Zach Greinke through the seventh inning, mm-hmm. or you put Gerrit Cole in at that time. And Cole didn't seem too happy about it afterwards, and it really did open the door for the Nationals to beat the not best Houston pitchers. And if you're going to lose the World Series, you want your best to be beaten. The whole point is your best goes against their best, and A.J. Hinch totally blew it and did not put his team in a position to win. And the Nationals benefited, and it was exciting. They're a fun team. They are much like that 2010 team, where they're a mix of cast-offs and misfits and older guys and younger guys. You know, there was a lot of talk about how they're the oldest team in baseball, but you got guys like Soto, Robles, a couple other guys, just hand off the top of my head, that are in their 20s that were in the starting lineup. So it wasn't all a team of Howie Kendricks and Gerardo Parras. Mm-hmm. They definitely had a good mix of everything. And, you know, sometimes things just go your way. And when you have Steven Strasburg dealing like he did in this playoff run, good things are going to happen.
So you mentioned something at the beginning where you said it wasn't a very exciting World Series. And it, you know what? It's funny, because most of the time when you say a World Series goes seven games, you typically say, wow, that was a great World Series. That was an exciting World Series. But you couldn't be more correct about it. It's the same feeling I had walking away from it. Game one was the closest game in terms of runs. It was a one-run win by the Nationals. But the second game was a 9-run difference, 3-run difference, 7-run difference, 6-run difference, 5-run difference. And then the final game was a 4-run difference. Now, game seven was exciting in the sense that the Astros had a lead late. And you're just referring to that, where A.J. Hinch maybe made some questionable decisions, because him and Cole had an agreement prior to the game that he would only be brought in during a clean inning. So it does make sense that instead of bridging the gap with some of your relievers, that you just have Greinke continue, or you bring in Cole in that inning. But he hedged his bets and tried to bridge it, and it didn't work out. And it was exciting for that brief period of time, certainly in the seventh and eighth innings when Washington poured it on. But I tell you, man, you know, Greinke gave up a solo shot, and then later he was out. But when Kendrick came up and hit that ball to right field, I thought, you know, oh, that might be a single or a double down the line. And it just kept carrying and carrying and carrying. And that's, again, one of those, like, when the Giants played and the bunt, you know, stayed fair, or Hunter Pence's triple double, or the home run that bounced back off the top of the center field wall. Remember that? All those little things that happened to go into the Giants' favor, it seemed to happen to the Nats too, because here's this line drive down the right field line, and how many right-handers over the course of a season are going to hit one opposite field off the bottom of the foul pole? It's such a rarity, but that's what it took to kind of put the Nats in favor and in the lead, and they never looked back after that.
Yeah, and it's funny too, because a lot of the quote-unquote baseball breaks went the Nats' way, which was the opposite, because all the umpire breaks did not go the Nats' way. Yeah, I mean, right, the strike zones, the strike zones through the seven-game series, this is the worst World Series I've ever seen for strike zones. And then you had to play in Game 6, which I don't know how deep we'll get into that, but you had to play in Game 6 where, you know, the interference was called on Trey Turner, and then Dave Martinez went apoplectic and, you know, got tossed for that game. And my favorite story from that is there was a fan behind the dugout when Davey was going nuts and he finally got tossed, screaming at Davey, "Davey, your heart, because he had a heart procedure back in September. That's right. So, you know, it's not the kind of stress-filled environment somebody with his condition at the time should have been in, but, you know, he didn't care at that moment. But it seemed like all the umpire breaks went against the Nats, and then all the baseball breaks, though, seemed to go their way. And that goes back to the decision-making of the Astros and, you know, the fact that that ball did – I thought it was going to curve foul when Kendrick hit that ball. It had that slice to it, you know, coming off the bat of a right-hander. And it was one of those lean jobs where you're like, is it? Oh, and it hit it. And, you know, it's funny because part of me was rooting for the Astros only because I picked them. And and I'm not going to like my wife really liked the players on the team of the Astros. She really likes Altuve. She really likes Springer. She found it fun to watch Cole, you know, all same things, you know, similarly to me, you know, all the other stuff that happened before the World Series notwithstanding. And she was aware of that. And I was aware of that. It just, you know, the Astros seemed like that team that should do it. And the Nationals just never died. You know, 5 elimination game victories is second in history to the 2012 Giants and the 1985 Royals, who won 6 elimination games each. So it just goes to show what kind of a resolve that team had. They did not sweat when they got in the later innings, and it showed. That inning, the 7th inning, you know, Rendon hit the homer off of Greinke, and then Greinke walked Soto. And personally, I thought Greinke was just pitching carefully to Soto. I didn't think that it showed that his stuff was gone. Mm-hmm. And Hinch decided to make the change, bring in, Will Harris. Yeah, Will Harris. And then Kendrick hit the homer. And the thing of it was I didn't expect Greinke to pitch that well in a game 7. And I'm sure you didn't. I'm sure nobody expected Greinke to pitch that well. And he was on fire. That the butterfly changeup was working. Everything was just perfect. And stuff fell apart. And as we know, baseball is a 9-inning game and not a 6-inning game. And the Nats were always able to take advantage. They were behind in every single elimination game they won. And aside from one of them, they were behind in the 6th inning or later,
right?
Which is just phenomenal. So, you know, the Nats, there's still something to be said for resolve and human spirit. And, you know, it's not all just statistics and numbers, because these guys, they really pulled themselves up from the bootstraps and they did the things that needed to be done.
Yeah, if you look at the stats, both teams gave up 30 earned runs in 63 innings pitched. They both had an identical 4.29 ERA. The Astros did out-hit the Nats 272 to 241. They had the Nats had 3 more runs than the Astros, 33 to 30, and both teams had 11 home runs. You look across the board and most of the hitting stats are in the Astros' favor, but not tremendously, and the pitching was fairly identical. And the Nationals just had the better hitting in terms of situational hitting. That's just basically what it comes down to. I mean, we are down to a game 7 in the 7th inning when the game swung the other direction. So it could have gone either way. I agree with you. I personally was pulling for the Nats, like you were saying, in terms of emotion, if you will, because you know, I picked the Astros. It was, I think it's in most baseball fans, if they don't have a vested interest in either one team, kind of pull for the one that's never won it before. It's like, hey, let's get a new one in the club here. Let's let that city kind of experience it. The Astros had just won it. They were in the playoffs in 2018. And it's not the players' fault, of course, for what happened with their, is it their general manager or assistant GM?
Assistant GM
who had that horrendous outburst in the locker room against those women reporters. And of course, he was fired and the Astros handled that extremely poorly. So there was a little bit of that schadenfreude in terms of, you know, you reap what you sow, but that has nothing to do with the players. So I do feel for the players themselves. They tried and it was just funny how home field advantage was a disadvantage this year. It just was opposite world. I don't know how else to explain it, but, you know, a lot of other neat things about every World Series that there's always new things that have happened, or hey, this is the first time this has happened since, you know, 19 whatever. But the Nats start at 19-31, which of course we heard ad nauseum is the worst start of any team to win the World Series. That's pretty sweet. The only other team that was 12 games under 500 at any point in the regular season and that won the World Series was the 1914 Boston Braves. The Nats went 8-1 on the road in the postseason, winning their last 8 such games. The 96 Yankees are the only other World Series winning team to match those numbers. Only one team has won 3 winner-take-all games in one postseason, and that's, of course, this year's Nats.
That one
pretty cool.
Surprised
that includes
me.
Yeah, I mean, it includes the wild card. But then it includes the Dodgers Game 5 and then the World Series Game 7. So yeah, that was one thing that did escape me too. That's pretty cool, you know, 3 winner-take-all games, not just elimination. Strasburg is the first number one overall pick to win World Series MVP and only the third player taken first or second to win the award. Let's see, the others are Josh Beckett, Reggie Jackson, and that's it, although Jackson did it twice. Only two other pitchers besides Strasburg have won five games in a single postseason. And that was the Angels' Francisco Rodriguez. Oh, that was 2002. Francisco Rodriguez for the Giants. And Randy Johnson for the Diamondbacks in 2001. And Strasburg is also the first one to do so without a loss. He was a perfect 5-0 in the postseason. The Nats won 12 games this postseason. Strasburg and Max Scherzer started 10 of those 12 games. And in each player's five starts, they won all 10, which that's pretty incredible. That ties for the most all-time with the Giants' Madison Bumgarner, the Cardinals' Chris Carpenter, Cliff Lee in 2009, Cole Hamels 2008, Curt Schilling 2001, and Andy Pettit 2000. You get a theme here. This is all since the expansion of the playoffs.
I also don't think we need now. Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, we're 25 years into the wild card era. So, you know, like the caveat of, you know, since the wild card era, I think that's starting to fall by the wayside as see some of these records fall. Mm-hmm. You know, and then I can pick it up a little if you want.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks.
You know, Anthony Rendon is the first player in Major League history to hit a home run in three straight elimination games in the same postseason. And that was game five against the Dodgers and then game six and seven of the World Series. In game six, Rendon became only the third player since 1920 with at least five runs driven in with his team facing World Series elimination. The other two were Danny Bautista of the Diamondbacks in 2001, which kind of surprised the crap out of me. But, I mean, to be fair, in 2001, Game 6, the Diamondbacks won like 15 or 16 to 1 or something like that. And Addison Russell of the Cubs in 2016 also drove in five runs as his team was facing elimination. And with his Game 7 home run, Howie Kendrick became only the sixth player in World Series history to hit a go-ahead home run in the seventh inning or later of Game 7. There's Roger Peckinpah of the 1925 Washington Senators, Hal Smith, and Bill Mazeroski of the 1960 Pirates. People forget that Hal Smith actually hit a home run in the bottom of the eighth to put the team ahead, and then the Yankees tied it up in the ninth before Bill Mazeroski's shot. Ray Knight of the 1986 New York Mets, and Alfonso Soriano of the 2001 Yankees, which is also fascinating considering the 2001 Yankees lost that Game 7. And he's the only Kendrick is the only player in MLB history with more than one go-ahead home run in the seventh inning or later of an elimination game. He hit that grand slam in Game 5 of the LDS, and he hit that two-run homer we've been talking about. And then Juan Soto, who he could have won MVP. I absolutely would have been fine had he won MVP. He would have actually gotten my vote. He hit five home runs in the postseason, which is a record for one player aged 21 or younger, and he is also the youngest player ever to hit three home runs in a single World Series, which is kind of funny because he hit one as a 20-year-old and two as a 21-year-old.
I was going to say he actually turned 21 during the World Series. So.
Yeah, and he had a crappy game on his birthday. Game three, he did not have a good game at all. I actually think the moment got to him when it came to that. But, you know, he recovered, and he was definitely a big part of them putting it away down the stretch.
So that kind of concludes a very sad portion of our podcasting year. That is the last time we're going to actually talk about a baseball game.
Yeah.
We're not doing so again until April of 2020. So it's a little melancholy for us. We love talking shop and talking baseball and stats and everything like that. But we are moving into the hot stove season. Now, this is typically the time of the year. Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I just want to touch on real quick. This solidifies the Giants as the team of the decade.
Yes.
We are leaving this decade, and the Giants are the only team to win three World Series during this decade. The Red Sox won two, and nobody else won more than one. So it really does solidify, you know, we can puff our chests out and we can raise our arms and say, yes, we had the best franchise in the decade. It may have been the first half of the decade, but we still had the best franchise of the decade.
Yeah, I had some fun. I didn't really troll them, but I was kind of belittling people. MLB on their Facebook page had asked, all right, here it is. Who's the team of the decade, right? And they preface it with a graphic which lists the winners from every year of the decade. So their question is, who is the team of the decade? Here's some reference for you, right?
Right.
So, I mean, 90% of the people posting, even once. I'm a Cubs fan. I'm an Indians fan. I'm a Royals fan. I'm a whatever fan. I mean, how can you not say the Giants? They won three. No one else won three. It's simple math. Right. It's like, why even ask this question, MLB? You're an idiot. Like, it's clearly the Giants. And then there are a lot of people, I mean, again, minority, but going, well, it has to be the 2016 Cubs because they broke a curse that was 108 years old. And then people were like, dude, they won one. The Giants won three. Which one is greater? You know? And they'd be like, it doesn't matter how many you won. It's about how important it was and how exciting the games were. And people are like, going back and forth. And there were some random people going, well, the Nationals, it was their first, you know, World Series for the city. And they hadn't won in blah, 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 blah. And people were like, yeah, the same for the Giants in 2010. Oh, and by the way, they won again in 2012 and 2014. You know?
Yeah.
Nats fans going, well, they won five elimination games this year. That should give them the team of the decade. And they're like, in the last year of the decade? Oh, by the way, the Giants won nine consecutive elimination games when you go between two seasons. Like, it was so funny. Just all these people that were making cases for their team that had won one. Couple Royals fans here and stuff like that. And anyway, it was a lot of fun to kind of go back and forth with these people who were just so passionate about their team.
Astros won, honestly, had the Astros won, they might have had an argument. I know it still would have been 2-3.
Yeah.
But the Astros have absolutely been the team of the second half of the decade.
Oh, sure.
And had they finished the job, then yeah, maybe they would have had an argument. But they didn't finish the job.
Nope. So we are looking
onto the hot stove.
Yeah, we're looking down the barrel here, getting pretty close to Farhan Zaidi making a decision on who the Giants' next manager is going to be. And this is typically a decision that is not made very often in Giants history. I mean, you know, you and I have not been alive for too many managers when you think about it. You know, we got Bruce Bochy. We got I'm bad food there. We had Felipe Alou prior to that, Dusty Baker. Then we had Roger Craig, and then before that it was Frank Robinson, right? Or was there someone in between?
I think there was somebody in between. I don't know if it was Altabelli or not.
But see, we're going all the way back to basically the 70s now, and you know, I was born in 73, so it's really just a handful of managers that, and since I've been a fan from like say the early 80s, it really was Roger Craig was my first manager that I really started following the team. So it's been Craig to you know, all these guys. So it's only been five or six managers, and it's an important decision.
Yeah, they're all like titans. I mean, look at these names that you're mentioning. Like, I have vivid memories of every one of these managers. You know, Craig with the 87 and the 89 teams, Dusty with the 93, 97, and 02 teams, you know, Philippe with the 03 team, which we still agree is probably the greatest regular season team the Giants have ever had. Mm-hmm. And then you got Bochy after that, and he was able to do the things he was. You know, anybody who steps into this role, they might not realize what they're succeeding at this point. And, you know, it makes this whole managerial search a little curious because, you know, back in the day, we knew who Dusty was when he got hired, but it wasn't like, you know, oh, you know, he's the hot guy, he's going to take us there. And then he did. You know, it makes this decision that Farhan has to make even more important, because if this next manager doesn't last 4+ years and bring at least a division title to the Giants, he's going to go down as a failure.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the Giants have always been the antithesis of a good chunk of major leagues in terms of teams that cycle through managers quicker than, you know, people go through girlfriends. Yeah. So it's just one of those things where, you know, a lot of heavy weight is on Zaidi's shoulders right now. And you're right. If a new manager comes in and doesn't perform within the first 3 years, 4 years, it's a failure and probably would be moving on to another person at that point. But the list is down to a precious three, maybe four. Apparently there was a late addition. But it's down to Gabe Kapler, Joe Espada, and Pedro Grifol being the finalists. And apparently there's a late addition, Los Angeles Dodgers field coordinator Clayton McCullough. I don't know much about him. That was just reported today or yesterday. But we've expressed our opinions about Gabe Kapler.
Yes.
And he's received two interviews. So has Espada and Grifol. We were just talking about before the show, Grifol, we still really don't know anything about him. And from what we have been able to read and ascertain, we're both fans of Joe Espada at this point in terms of what's remaining on this list. So I don't know. This is definitely not a list that I expected to see. I'm not sure what I expected. I just expected some more names that I knew, and this isn't it, you know?
So yeah, that's where I was at. Joe Espada is definitely my favorite in the clubhouse. He's 44 years old. He's of Puerto Rican descent. He was born in San Juan, and he has taken the track that you want to see a good manager take. He played minor league ball. He never made it to the majors. Then he was a coach with the Marlins for a few years. Then the Yankees hired him to be a third base coach and an infield coach. And then he's been the bench coach for the last 2 years with the Astros, who definitely, like we just said, are the best team of the back half of this decade. And the last bench coach for the Houston Astros was Joey Cora, who won a title with Boston the very next year. So I like Espada so far. He sounds like he is a younger version of a Ron Wotus, possibly. And I like that idea because guys like Wotus and Bam Bam, they really didn't get a fair shake in this managerial search. And, I mean, I'm not surprised at that. I mean, did you really expect them to keep any of the old guard?
Not at all. Not at all. And not with the new GM coming in. Well, he's not the GM. He's the president of baseball operations. But, yeah, point being, I did not think they were going to keep these guys around.
Right. Like, Bam Bam is, I think, joining the Marlins staff. I think there's been talk that Wotus, Seattle might be interested in Wotus for something. So, you know, these guys have gotten permission to move on. This Pedro Grifol, I can't find anything on him. And Clayton McCullough doesn't even have a Wikipedia page. That's how famous he is at this point. So, you know, I want to see Espada, but I'm really concerned they're going to go Kapler. And at that point, I mean, just got to hope that certain things from the past are not the same type of things today.
For sure. All right.
Yeah, but I mean,
You want to say something else about Kapler?
No, I mean, the thing of it is Farhan talked about that sometimes getting a retread is not a bad thing, that they learn stuff in their first job. And if Kapler didn't have all the baggage, I actually think he'd be a good choice. I think that's what's frustrating about it is he's got all this other baggage and Farhan really, you know. But, I mean, it's the Giants. This is the list of things that the Giants need is so long. It's ridiculous. Like, I saw Pav put a tweet out, like, right when the World Series ended. Okay, time for the offseason. The Giants need a general manager. They need a manager. They need a coaching staff. They don't know if they're going to re-sign Bumgarner or Smith. You know, they don't know. We still haven't heard about renovations to the ballpark or anything like that. Like, there are so many questions heading into this offseason that there's no way we can come up with answers today. You know, the best free agency starts today. All the qualifying offers that were put out there, like if the Giants give Bumgarner a qualifying offer, which I haven't even read if they did or not, same with Will Smith, and the offer gets declined, then, you know, they earn a draft pick if they sign elsewhere. But this is probably one of the biggest off seasons we're going to see as Giants fans over the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, it's a year in which a lot of salaries cleared off the books, and we have these big free agents, and it's going to shape their next 3 years minimum. And they have some big guys coming off the books next year too, with Posey and Crawford and others. But today is the first day they can submit qualifying offers. Free agency does open today. I do fully expect that the Giants will submit a qualifying offer to both Will Smith and Bumgarner. I don't expect either one of them to take it, but that would ensure that the Giants get draft pick compensation for it. So there's really no harm in doing that per se if they sign somewhere else. Most teams end up, I think, doing that with their superstars that they know are going to leave. But it was sad. I actually clicked on, right before the podcast, clicked on the Giants 40-man and active roster and just noticed there's no Madison Bumgarner listed there. It's a very odd feeling. You know, he's been there since 2010, so for 10 years, he's always showed up on that roster, and here he is. He's gone from it. Doesn't mean he's not going to be with the team next year, but I think you and I expected him some. Well, I expected him. I don't think you did. To be traded, he wasn't, because of that magical July that they had where they pulled back into the race. It kind of forced his hand to not trade Bumgarner and see what, you know, where he could take the team. But with this new regime coming in, or, you know, and Bochy leaving and the whole old coaching staff and him being able to set up his manager and field generals, I just fully expect him to look at Bumgarner the way that Bill Walsh used to look at his aging stars, is cut them before they decline precipitously. And I think that it's not just a cut, of course. It's just not re-signing him to a ridiculous contract, which the Giants have been notoriously found to do. There are World Series thank you contracts for all these guys, where at the back end of their careers, and certainly after they sign these massive contracts, they just do not perform up to the dollar amount. And unfortunately, I would love Bumgarner to be on the team. I really would. I think he has a lot of value, obviously, still left in him. He's only 30, going on 31. You know, look at Max Scherzer and others. They're still pumping. Strasburg's 31, and look, he was just named MVP of the World Series. He's going to get paid mega bucks. He just opted out of his Nationals contract, which was still $100 million for 4 years.
I couldn't imagine leaving that on the table.
And he left it on the table. Not. So when you look at that, but, you know, Bumgarner still has
he's another example.
There you go. He's 36, right? So
yeah.
He has the potential, but he's had some signs of slowing down. And if that accelerates and he signs some mega 5-6 year deal, you know, for $30 million a year with the Giants, that's going to kill him. That's going to kill him. And Zaidi is like probably going to pump the brakes on that and not do it.
Yeah, I mean, this is just, it's not the days of Brian Sabian and Bobby Evans anymore. The Giants are not going to hand out crappy contracts. And the roster, as we saw last year, when they used 64 players, a National League record during the season, we know that the roster is going to continually churn and that Zaidi is really trying to work the back half. My biggest thing going into free agency, and this sounds weird, but my biggest thing going into free agency is they keep talking about how Oracle Park's dimensions are going to change. Yet we haven't heard yet what's going to happen and if or when. And I think free agents need to know this. I think free agents need to know that the park is changing if they're going to consider coming here. Because, you know, we heard Bryce Harper, you know, part of the reason he said no to the Giants was because of the ballpark. And how many other, you know, players have looked at the Giants and been like, I don't want to play on that ballpark. You know, Giancarlo Stanton a few years ago when he was being courted in the trade deadline, you know, he used the Giants as leverage. But who knows? Maybe if the Giants had a more hitter friendly park at that time, he would have been OK with it instead of just using us as his screw job. So, you know, it makes me wonder if they need to come out and say something about that, if that is part of the timeline, you know, because like I said, they need a general manager. They need a manager. So once they get these things in place, are they going to announce that? And is it possible that they're holding off on this because free agency just takes longer nowadays? I mean, look at last year with, you know, Machado and Harper not signing till February and March. So it's possible that this stuff comes out later, but the Giants' house really needs to get in order, and it's very curious to see what happens. You know, you got the list here: Baum elected free agency, Pablo elected free agency, Will Smith, and Stephen Vogt. And Stephen Vogt, it's a shame. He came out and said he wants a chance for a ring, and he's not going to get that with the Giants next year. No. So I don't think he's going to be back.
Yeah, he's that's an unfortunate loss, but I agree with you. I think that he's trying to chase that ring. He's getting up there in age, and he knows the Giants are not a year or two away from a World Series. They're more than that. So, yeah, he's probably going to take his chances elsewhere.
Yeah, especially with Joey Bart coming up over his shoulder at this point.
Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, you know, the whole catching situation next year could be very fluid when it comes to that. And, you know, the Giants did make, you know, well, the Giants made one positive move, and a player also chose to make a move. The Giants claimed left-handed pitcher Tyler Anderson off waivers from the Rockies, and they cut Bear Claw. And Tony Watson picked up his player option. He will be back. He chose to want to stay with the Giants. And, you know, while he had his bumps in the road, he is still a good left-handed stalwart in that bullpen. And, you know, I appreciate that he wants to stay with the Giants. You know, you have to wonder if that same thought is pervasive among the other guys, but I doubt it. I see Bum going to Atlanta or something like that. Pablo's coming off surgery, so I don't think he's going to sign with anybody. You know, who knows if Will Smith wants to come back to the Giants, but, you know, he seemed to love his time here. So
Yeah. We
have more questions than answers. And that's, I think, really the biggest problem right now is we're all kind of just in that waiting period.
And then if you guys are wondering about what's going on with Kevin Pillar, he is not a free agent, but he is arbitration eligible. So that means that his salary, he can negotiate with through an arbitrator to get a higher salary if the Giants don't offer him an adequate contract. So he was paid $5.8 million last year by the Giants, And according to MLB trade rumors, they're calculating, estimating his arbitration salary to be about $9.7 million next year. So that's almost a $4 million bump. And so the Giants, who still have control over Pillar, he's not a free agent, have the option of letting him go, of going to arbitration, or to offer him a contract. Now, if they did offer him a contract before arbitration, it could be at that estimated amount. It could be above that amount if they want to avoid arbitration, or they could try and meet him somewhere in the middle. Now, Pillar, I think, you know, he's expressed interest in staying in San Francisco. He likes the city. He likes the fans. His family likes being here. But that said, I can't imagine the Giants are going to offer him something like $7.5 million, because that's $2 million less than the arbitration estimate. And at that point, if you're the Giants, it's $2 million and you're going to, you know, risk him not walking, but going into arbitration with hurt feelings, right? And that could translate into a season that you don't want that to have happen. But you also don't want to overpay the guy. So it's a tough call, because he's become quickly a fan favorite. And, you know, just with his hustle and his diving catches out there, you know, a la Superman, which of course is his nickname. And he's had some big hits for the Giants. But when you really crack his numbers, and Zaidi is a numbers guy, he has, especially for a leadoff batter, or at least a top of the lineup guy, a very high strikeout rate and a very poor on-base percentage. And those are two big glaring red marks on his ledger. And so I think it's going to be hard for someone like Zaidi to authorize offering him $9 or $10 million for just 1 year. And that's really considering the free agents that they might try to go for, including someone like a Gerrit Cole, by the way. So they might want to save as much as they can and cut corners where they can. And if they were to let him walk or just go to arbitration and get the $9 million, I don't know. It's a tough call for me, because I would love to see him back, but I also don't want that to hurt their chances of signing some of these free agents.
Yeah, I agree. And we've talked about it on the show before. The Giants' history of arbitration is that they don't go to arbitration. I don't think Sabian went to arbitration at all, or maybe they did once back in like the late 90s or early 2000s was the last time. But again, this is not the Sabian years anymore. And the Giants may be willing to go to arbitration because they may think that they have a great case. But like you said, that causes hurt feelings with players. We've seen it in the past. We've seen, I think it was Corey Kluber or somebody last year, you know, who talked about, you know, all the horrible things that his team basically said about him. You know, and that really is the flaw in the arbitration process. Yeah. Because you're in one hand, you're saying we want this guy, but we just don't think he's as valuable as he thinks he is.
Yeah, and you're in a closed room, and you're literally digging up all of the negative aspects of the player that you want to sign. So it's a really odd situation for the representative for the team to be in, and certainly for the player himself.
Yeah, and any business, I would imagine that would create hurt feelings, you know? I couldn't imagine trying to re-sign with a company and then the company sitting across the table from me going, well, yeah, he's good, but he doesn't do this, he doesn't do this, he doesn't do that. And I'd be like, then why do you think I'm good?
Yeah.
You know? So I with Pillar, like you said, I mean, he was the Willie Mack winner. He was a lot of fun. Everybody enjoyed him. But I agree. He doesn't really deserve more than he got 5.8 last year. You know, I could see his pay being bumped up to 7 tops, but I don't see the Giants, you know, willing to pay that $9.7 million figure that could be coming in at the top of the arbitration scale. So I think we're going to see the Giants go to arbitration or possibly part ways with him. You know, the fact that they have all these contracts of Crawford and Belt and Posey on the books probably hinders their ability to be more flexible financially. And, you know, I don't know, we'll get into that in the offseason when they, you know, possibly trade Belt. And although I've been saying that for years, so, you know, so we'll see what happens with that. But, you know, the Giants, it's like I said earlier, we have way more questions than we do answers. And the things that we may want to see happen may be the complete opposite of the way Farhan's thinking.
Yeah, and one thing that I think Farhan and the brass knows very well is that they have Steven Duggar as the center field of the future. And he just keeps getting injured, and he certainly has never had the production close to what Pillar has. So if they part ways with Pillar and then go with Duggar, and even if he doesn't get hurt, he's definitely, well, shouldn't say definitely, but most likely he's not going to have the same productive season that Pillar had in 2019. So You know, these are things they have to think about. And are they going to risk sacrificing center field production, which traditionally the Giants have always lacked outfield production, to sign someone or for something else? And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it might only be a couple million dollars. It might not make a big splash or big difference anywhere. But you do set examples, and then future players will want that much money, and you just kind of, it's a snowball effect. So you have to be careful with offering players too much or over their value. So.
Yeah. Farhan's dancing through the raindrops this offseason. He's got to try to stay dry.
All right. Well, as we go into the offseason here, I'm sure Eric and I will figure out our schedule. It's not going to be a regular schedule, as in every week or two. It'll be kind of when big events happen. Signings of free agents, which we don't expect for quite some time. Certainly the signing of a new manager will probably broadcast or record shortly after that happens. But other than that, we'll just drop in periodically to talk about developments, not only with the San Francisco Giants, but in the baseball world in general. If there's a big splash somewhere or something of note, we'll talk about it. But yeah, this is where we start quieting down a little bit heading into the holiday season. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, Eric, but that's typically what we do.
Yeah, we'll get back on the mic for Hall of Fame type stuff. The Veterans Committee today released their nominees for the Hall of Fame. Names like Lou Whitaker and stuff like that were on there. I'm a big fan of Marvin Miller. He is the guy who basically created the Players Union back in the 70s and got them to where they are today. And, you know, I'm a big proponent for him. But that's just periphery stuff. So I'm sure we'll talk Hall of Fame stuff, but that's not until January. Yeah. So, you know, we don't have much going on right now. And, you know, the Giants themselves, we'll have to see if they drag their feet or if they go 0-60. And I have a feeling it's going to be a feet dragging.
Well, I just want to thank everybody for listening to this entire baseball season. It was certainly the most podcasts we've ever produced in one regular season. So I really appreciate all the support. The numbers have been good. The responses have been good. And Eric and I have really enjoyed it. And that's why I've been recording at a fairly regular clip from April through now. So we really do appreciate the support. Speaking of support, you can follow us at torchcast.com or on Facebook. Just Google us there. Of course, on Twitter, just at TorchCast. You can follow us individually at ChadK21 for myself or at 2OutHits for Eric. That's with the number 2. Eric is definitely the more active of us two. So if you want entertainment or to get into arguments, definitely talk to him. So I tweet once a week, maybe.
After the World Series, though, I had to take a hiatus. That game 6 specifically with the play.
Oh, I know. I know.
Because I felt like everybody was attacking me personally, and all I was trying to do was explain how the rule was applied. Yeah. And then all the examples that I were given, no offense to you and everybody else who gave me examples, but the examples didn't matter. Because the only reason that the play mattered was because the ball was thrown weird and the glove went off him. But, you know, like Altuve ran out of the runner's lane, you know, very next inning and nothing was called because there was no interference. And that was just, that's something I'm an expert in. So I was a little defensive. And if I was overly defensive to some people, you know, I guess I kind of apologize. It's not really sincere.
It's definitely a rule that the committee needs to take a look at. And I know they discussed it before, absolutely. But it's clearly a bad rule because essentially – And it says it right there in black and white. I understand the interpretation of the rule. I just don't agree with it, the spirit of the rule. It's, you know, a right-hander, specifically a right-hander, left-handers sometimes, but right-hander starts running out of the box in foul territory. They start running in fair territory. The base is in fair territory, but the runner's lane is in foul territory. So they have to, by the letter of the law, that last half of that lane, they have to have their feet to the foul side of the baseline and then curve back at the last second to be able to hit the bag. And so, in the case of this particular play, he absolutely was inside the lane all the way from point A to point B, never went into foul territory, never went into the runner's lane. So I understand the application of the rule. It's just funny because when you talk about the actual physical product of interference, his left foot, which is his inside foot, was in the middle of the bag and his outside foot was basically in foul territory. So he certainly wasn't in a position that would normally indicate he was trying to interfere with the play. And if he started in the runner's lane and came back and hit that exact same part of the bag, he still would have hit the, you know, the same interference would have happened, but hypothetically he would have been called safe, while someone who ran in the runner's lane could hypothetically put their outside foot, their right foot, on the inside of the bag, right? And have their body even further into fair territory and cause interference, and they hypothetically would not be called out. So it's definitely something that the committee has to look at, I think.
But. Yeah, I agree. It's not the greatest rule. And I'm in real time when it happened, I immediately said out loud,
said
that's
it.
Interference. Yeah, I did. I immediately said it out loud. Yeah.
And
it was funny because the wife turned to me. She's like, what? How? And I'm like, just watch. They're going to call that an interference. Yeah, and I personally think the solution, you know, again, it's not that I'll always defend the umpires. I'll defend the umpires applying the rules because you heard me earlier, trash strike zones.
Anyway.
Oh my God, they were horrible. I think the solution is the extended base, the orange base. I honestly think that's the solution. And I don't care if it takes away the purity look of the diamond. Mm-hmm. If you are asking people to run in foul territory, you have to give them a base to hit in foul territory.
Yeah.
You cannot force somebody to take an extra step because you're slowing them down. You're doing something that is not normal. So, you know, as you said, many debates like that happen on my Twitter account. I am a rules expert. I will call myself that. I did go to umpire school. My favorite umpire instructor at umpire school happens to be Sam Holbrook, who made the call.
Oh, no way.
I'm not even kidding. Sam and I got along famously. He's got a fantastic sense of humor. You know, I could give him crap. He could give me crap. It was, you know, I'll never forget. We were learning about bench clearing incidents. And so we were pretending to be the players and then rush the field, you know, and then the umpires have to sort it out. We were getting taught how to do that. And I didn't rush the field with everybody else. And he turned to me. He's like, what the hell are you doing sitting here? I'm like, I'm the pitcher with the $6 million arm, man. I'm not going out there. And exactly. There was fun respect that came from it. So it's just kind of ironic that Sammy is the guy that I really identified with the most. Because trust me, there are many other umpires that I didn't identify with. And there are very many umpires who come from places like Kentucky who have some very strange views.
Yes.
And, you know, as somebody who grew up Jewish, I actually ran into some of that at umpire school. So it is still a boys club like that. So I do understand how people look at it. So, but you know, when it comes to baseball and talking, you know, rules and different thoughts and stuff like that, that's why Chad mentioned my Twitter account is a little more active. I will definitely get into it and I will definitely defend my stance. And if you bring up a point that is, you know, valid opposite my stance, I'm always willing to change my mind. I've said I'm wrong on this podcast 1,000 times. I'm 40 years old. I don't have time to try to be right about everything. I'd rather learn and move on. So, yeah, like Chad said, you know, you can follow him on Twitter, ChadK21, and you can follow me at 2OutHits. And then we've got all of our other places, YouTube, Facebook, you know, where you get your podcasts. Obviously, if you're listening to this, you already know where to get your podcasts. And I want to echo Chad's thought. 2019, I got to say, this was the most fun season for me doing this show. It's really strange to say, considering the season the Giants had. But I really did. You know, Chad put in a lot of hard work this year. I put in a lot of hard work this year. And it's really good to see the fruits of our labor and really appreciate the listeners. Because if you guys weren't listening to this podcast, we wouldn't be doing it anymore. So I really do appreciate the fans and you, Chad. I'm really grateful for this season. I had a ball. It was really the best season I think we've had as Torture Cast. And I think we can move forward in the future and be even better.
I think so. I think that this kind of proved to us that, you know, plenty of people will listen if we record more regularly. You and I really enjoyed just talking about the season and our banter back and forth and even just talking offline and all that stuff. So, you know, it's funny. I don't think people realize that even though you and I have been doing this podcast for a number of years now, we've actually only met each other one time.
Yeah.
Is that weird?
One
or what?
Time. And it's over 6 years ago.
Yeah, but we've spoken for, God, I don't know, probably well over, you know, a couple hundred hours or something baseball and just random crap pre and post game. So, yeah, no, good stuff. Well said, Eric. I do appreciate it. And I'm hoping next year we'll have a little bit more in terms of resources and time to maybe explore a few other products. We've dabbled in some of the video products before, and we'll talk about them in the off season, but there's got to be of course, an audience for it too. We're not going to, but it's a chicken and egg thing too. You know, it's like sometimes you need to develop something before people listen to it to gain the traction. But other products, you kind of want to have a base following already. So you know that you're not going to put all these additional hours into a product that, you know, only a handful of people are going to regularly consume. So it's a balance because, like, you all know, we're not paid for this. We're not getting ad revenue. We're not sponsored. We've had like a couple sponsors ever. So we do this, you know, just out of hobby, out of our time, out of our passion for the Giants and baseball. So, again, we do appreciate your patronage. So that'll do it for episode 186, and we will be back at some point, probably in the next few weeks, maybe even sooner, depending when the Giants do sign their new manager, for episode 187. Until then, this is Chad signing off. We'll see you then. A-boom.
Okay, Boomer.
A big thank you to everybody for listening to the Torture Cast, the podcast by and for fans of the San Francisco Giants. Follow us on Twitter at TortureCast. You can also like us on Facebook or check out our blog at torturecast.com. I also want to say thank you to Ashcon and Bailey for letting us use their song Feeling Like a Giant for our intro. For Ben Lee and Chad King, my name is Willie Dills saying, we'll see you next time.